Now, technically, I've skipped over some things. I've ignored the fact that paradise has to endow the unqualified absolute with space potency. I cover that in the appendix. But this is one of the things I choose to ignore in the story. It's not important. It's the way it works out in the end. And it just will complicate and bug the reader to bring that in at this point. However, I refer to the appendix, and in the appendix, it's made very clear. C, associated deity. Now we're taking our next step toward the outer edge of the zero age and factual reality. Again, a definition is in order. Associative is defined in Webster as tending to, inducing, or characterized by association. Perhaps the first associative act that we should note is the association of the two absolutes, qualified and unqualified. It comes about something like this. Since both of them come from the same original static reality, they are related, and the relationship between them is quite real. We could put it this way. When the one became two, then we have one and another. The word and is also a reality, and it universally links together the two absolutes that contain all of God's plans for the future. Since this linking up action is universal, it has been named the universal absolute. The universal absolute links the other two together like the middle link in a three-link chain. This is a good way to try to visualize the three absolutes. Draw three circles so that the middle one cuts a little way into the outer two. This makes a chain of three links. See chart. I got a picture of this. This linking up of the three absolutes is one of the associative relationships of eternity. We should now consider another such relationship. This is a relationship which God enters into and through which he becomes the universal Father. The pre-Father becomes the Father. Up to now, we have been thinking of God as a pre-Father. Actually, we have been thinking of him as pre-God as well as pre-Father. Up to now, as we have been thinking of him, God is the absolute person. As the absolute person, he is imprisoned inside all the limitations of being absolute. He fills up all of deity. The deity qualified absolute. He is all of deity. There is no deity outside of him. There is no room for action or maneuver. So God sets out to produce some room. What he does is to separate himself from all deity, just as he separated himself from all reality when he moved the qualified absolute away from the unqualified absolute. How does God do this? Well, he does it by separating himself from the absolute person. When he separates himself from the absolute person, three things happen. A, in removing himself from the absolute person, God causes this being to exist separate and apart from himself. He thus becomes the cause and the source of the absolute person. B, if God is the cause and the source of something, and if that something is a person, then God is the father of that person. And if he can be the father of the absolute person, then God can be the father of any and all persons, and thus he becomes the universal father. C. This makes the absolute person the original Son of God. And he is nonetheless the absolute person for becoming the Son of God. Because all of this is happening in eternity, it is customary to speak of this original Son as the eternal Son. I've tried always to reason why did they pick these words. There's a reason why they call him the eternal Son. This is the beginning of the divine fraternity of the eternal persons of deity, which will soon be completed by the appearance of the third person, the infinite spirit. Section 3, Existential Thesis, Antithesis, and Synthesis. We have used four unusual words in the caption to this section. They will bear defining before we go on with the study. Existential is a word that is especially used in the papers. It means something eternal, without a beginning or an ending, and with no need to learn by experience. Full knowledge is possessed without any experience. Existential is used as the opposite of experiential. God is existential. Man, as an example, is experiential. Now, for the other three terms. They are borrowed from the philosopher Hegel, who made much of them. We will use them several times in our study. Thesis, antithesis, and synthesis are in part defined in Webster as follows. With Hegel, thesis is the proposition or conception representing the first stage of developing thought, contrasting with the second stage or antithesis, which negates the thesis, and with the third stage or synthesis, in which thesis and antithesis are brought together. Thesis, then, is a proposition, a statement, a presentation. Antithesis, which would be better understood if it were written antithesis, is something that is different from, contrastive to, and stimulative of the thesis, but not necessarily antagonistic to the thesis. Synthesis is the bringing of the two together into a mutually expanded and harmonious whole. This is a three-step process, and we will see it develop more than once in our study of the Master Universe.
Is it always necessarily negativist?
No. I say not necessarily antagonistic.
No.
It's always different from.
But you use it in defining it. You use the word negative.
Yes.
Or negative.
It negates.
Negates.
But negation, it might or might not be antagonistic. But it's always a negation. It's always different. Contrastive. Stimulating.
Okay.
Synthesis of the three absolutes of potentiality. We have already seen this three-step process in operation, but we did not apply our new names to it. When the qualified and the unqualified absolutes are linked together by the universal absolute, this is the synthesis of two opposites. The qualified absolute is the potential deity thesis. The unqualified absolute is the potential non-deity antithesis. The universal absolute unites them. The non-synthesis of actual reality. Non-synthesis. Let us go back to the times when God is separating himself from the absolute person and is becoming the father of that absolute person, who thereby becomes his original son. At this same time, God the Father constructs the absolute machine, the Isle of Paradise. He builds it for the same reason that we build machines, to do something relatively mechanical and repetitive. The Isle of Paradise is designed to be the physical center and controller of the physical universes. The Eternal Son is the spiritual center and controller of the spiritual creation. The Son is personal and spiritual. He is the actual deity thesis. Paradise is neither personal nor spiritual. It is the actual non-deity antithesis of the Son. Here we have a situation that is quite like the two absolutes, the main difference being that the absolutes are potential, while the Son and Paradise are actual. We have seen that God synthesized the two absolutes in and by the universal absolute. If we did not know better, we might expect that he would do the same thing with the Son and Paradise, But God is not mechanical, and this did not happen. The unpredictable happened. The unification of actual deity reality. God does not synthesize paradise and the sun, the actuality of the not spiritual and the spiritual. What he does is to unify all actual deity reality, starting out with himself and the sun. In so uniting, the Father-Son produce a third being who will forever be the perfect expression, not of either one, but of both, the conjoined action of the Father-Son. This is the origin of the God of action, the infinite spirit. In a way, this is a superimposition of thesis upon thesis. The Son is the original, actual deity thesis. The Father has become the pre-thesis of deity. The Spirit is the conjoint thesis of actual deity. Their union in the Trinity is the undivided thesis of existential deity. But if we had not been told about this, we might have expected that God would have synthesized the Spirit Son with not Spirit Paradise. This would have produced a balanced situation. Actuals would have been synthesized just like potentials. We could not have foretold that God would unite himself with the Son in the Spirit. This produces an artistic asymmetry that stands in contrast to a mathematical or a mechanical symmetrical balance. This is like the difference between putting a dot in the exact center of a triangle and locating it somewhat off-center. God as an artist evidently takes precedence over God as an engineer. When God does unify a part of actual reality, he causes this association to include deity only. He does not associate all actual reality. He limits this union to actual deity reality. God leaves paradise out. Since paradise is left out of this existential association, it presents a problem for all of God's later appearing associates and subordinates of experiential status. And now, at last, we have reached the dawn of eternity at the close of the Zero Age and the beginning of factual reality in the first age of the Master Universe, the Age of Havona. That's a new approach, I think. You want more? You've got the last revision. Well, for example, Ed, when we got to the absolute person, Ed Jones was sitting down here at the end. He said, "I don't get it." Well, I think I had one short paragraph covering that, and I got a whole page now with A, B, C. And you see, it was Ed's complaint that has cleared it. Now let's get some more complaints, and we'll make it a little longer and a little. We'll break it down farther. Third prologue, the first universe age. The first real universe age is the age of Havona. We might logically begin our study of the Master Universe at this point, except for one small technicality. Havona never was created. And if this statement seems to be unreasonable, and it does seem as though eternal Havona actually was created, then we would ask the one unanswerable question, when? Later on, we will find it convenient to look at Havona as a real creation, but at this point, it is more convenient to be very technical and classify it as a pre-creation. Section 1, the dawn of eternity. The beginning of the first age. Let us go back for a moment to the close of the Zero Age and take an inventory. We have the three absolutes, deity, unqualified, and universal, all linked together. These are the infinite reservoirs that contain all of God's plans for the future. This means that they are potentials. They are often designated the absolutes of potentiality. What existed in the way of actuals? There are just three actualities, the Universal Father, the Eternal Son, and the Isle of Paradise. In other words, there are two existential deities and a physical base from which they can take action. This inventory is quite important to this study, so we will repeat it. At the end of the Zero Age, there are two existential deities plus a base of operations. That is all there is of actualized reality. Trinitization at the dawn of the First Age. We've used a new term, trinitization, and we should define it before we go on with this study. Trinitization has a special meaning in the papers. As we are using it here, it means a once-only act of creation, limited trinitization. The trinitizing partners put everything they have into this action. They produce a being equal to themselves, and they become united in some manner. This type of trinitization cannot be repeated. What is it that ends the Zero Age and begins the First Age? The action that begins the Age of Favona is a deity trinitizing act on the part of the two existential deities. This produces some immediate additions to and changes in the inventory of actualized reality. A. The Father and the Son unite as the Father-Son. B. The Infinite Spirit appears as their deity equal. C. The central universe of Favona makes its appearance. D. The Father, Son, and Spirit unite as the Paradise Trinity. In the dawn of the First Age, we now have the three absolutes of potentiality, the three persons of deity, Paradise and the central universe, and the Trinity. These realities are all pre-creative. None of them ever had a real beginning. Each one is eternal, and each one is absolutely eternal. At this juncture, Paradise bestowed on the unqualified absolute the potential of all the uncreated physical universes of all the future. In our previous discussions of the unqualified absolute, we have assumed that this has taken place. That's my apologies for being technically incorrect earlier. I got to be careful of the sea lawyers here too, you know, that are going to hair split on me. Section 2. An inventory of eternal existential realities. We took inventory of what was in existence in the twilight of the closing of the Zero Age, and it would be a good idea to repeat this process in the dawn of the First Age. In taking this inventory, it will be helpful to classify the seven absolute realities, the seven absolutes of infinity, under three main headings. There are several ways in which this classification can be made. The most helpful and informative seems to be the following. A. The absolute original, God the Universal Father. B. The absolute actuals, the Son, Paradise, and the Spirit. C. The absolute potentials, deity, unqualified, and universal. Now here, reading breaks down a little bit, because what I've done, I've set up a word illustration, just like a picture facing this text. And on it, I've laid out this classification with a minimum of explanation. And I've taken it completely out of the text so that it's unified on one sheet. And when we print this book, we'll get it on one sheet if we have to use smaller type. Because I think it's helpful to see it laid out with just enough there to make the classification real. And I think this is a communication device which we can use all the way through. We'll use standard charts and pictures, then we'll use word pictures. On the chart facing this page, such a classification, would you like to look at this? On the chart facing this page, such a classification has been made. This classification emphasizes certain functional relationships which underlie all growth and change. All of the post-Tavona creation and evolution of things and beings has come into existence as reality has been transferred from the potential to the actual in the presence of the original. Are you running out of tape, Bert? Let's take a stretch for a minute.
Yeah.
...of eternal and existential reality. So far as concerns the seven absolutes of infinity, we must take account of the Paradise Trinity and the central universe of Avona. They are also existential and eternal. Section 3, the existential Trinity. What is a trinity? A trinity is something new in our study. It is deity, but it is not personality. We know that the Paradise Trinity is the union of Father, Son, and Spirit. We probably think of this trinity rather loosely, more or less like three persons working together. But it is not these three persons at all. The trinity is something real in and of itself. Something that exists separate and apart from these three persons. We might think of the Paradise Trinity as a corporation that is organized by the three persons of deity. If we were to give this enterprise a corporate name, we would name it Undivided Deity Incorporated. This corporation has three directors, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. When they meet as directors, that is the corporation. And when they act in this capacity, this is the function of the corporation, the Trinity. When the three directors meet personally, socially, or informally, that is the meeting of three personalities, and it is not the Trinity. Any one or two or all three might do business as persons with the corporation, but they would be doing business as persons with the legal entity of their own corporation. And here again we should remember that the deities are all the time sitting as directors in the Trinity Union, and at the same time are apart from the Trinity and working together and individually as persons. They do not go from one activity to another. They do all of these things at the same time, and they do them all of the time. Absolute deity, even ultimate deity, is not limited by either time or space. A comparison of functions. We can see the difference between personal deity and trinity most clearly if we stop to consider the personal attitudes of the deities in contrast to their collective function in the trinity. The Father has a personal attitude of love for his creatures. The Son is the source of mercy, and mercy is love applied. The Spirit is the fountainhead of ministry, and ministry is mercy in action. In contrast to all of this, one of the important functions of the Paradise Trinity is justice administration. This is the collective and impersonal attitude of the deities. Justice administration is something very different from the personal attitudes of love, mercy, and ministry. Why is a trinity? Why not just have three persons of deity who can work with each other or not as they choose? In other words, why not just have a partnership? Why bother with a corporation? Why have a trinity? Apparently, deity really is indivisible. There can be threeness only so long as there is also a oneness. By having a trinity, God is able to keep the unity of deity, the oneness, and at the same time enjoy the association of two other equal beings. Just suppose that God had no one to talk to, no one that really understood him. It appears likely that deity is so indivisible that it could never be and never was actually divided at any point in time or eternity. We are about to consider a series of happenings that have been grouped together under the heading God's Escape from Infinity. We would suggest that all of these happenings are events that took place at the same time. Time in quotes. In other words, God could dissociate himself from total deity, the deity absolute, only by replacing his undivided pre-father deity presence with the undivided deity presence of the Paradise Trinity. As he removes his deity presence, he replaces it with the Trinity presence. While he is doing this, he is also becoming the Father of the Son, and with the Son, the trinitizing source of the Spirit.
Well, that might be...
Here's where we account for the dot.
If you lay down and go to bed with it for about 3 days and 3 nights, but their first time through.
All right. Maybe we need to say this even more clearly. In other words, Clyde, you start out with a circle with a dot. You start out with a circle with a dot, and here's where I think we need more language. And here's where I think we've come to the dot.
I'm glad that language there, but it didn't...
All right. You have God pervading, the pre-father pervading the deity absolute. He could never stop pervading the deity absolute unless he replaced it, his presence, with something equally pervasive. As he moves out, the Trinity moves in. It's a simultaneous movement. As he is moving out, the Trinity is moving in. And as he is moving out, he is becoming the Father of the Son, and with the Son, the source of the Spirit. All these things happened at the same time. It's a simultaneity. We think of them as sequence, but they weren't in sequence. In other words, I would put it this way, at no time was deity ever really divided. That's right. When he, at the same time that he personalized three ways, he unified.
Well, I think breaking that down into simpler is
going to be difficult. I don't say that you can. I'm not fussing about it. I think
that... Well, let's read on, because this ties right in with the question, what happened to the dot? And here's where we get the dot out. Oh, how nice. T-T-T. Team at Lemming.
I don't see that. I'll read that section in there.
I don't say we'll take this out, but we may say it again.
I certainly wouldn't recommend taking it out.
We may say it twice, though. Because saying it twice doesn't hurt. You say it once, you prepare the mind for what you're going to say, then you say it again, even in an ABC order, and then you really get your point across. Because this is tricky. Listen, this has bugged theologians for 2,000 years.
Yes, it's still fun.
So the mere fact that we're having a little trouble making it clear...
I've heard that menu again. I'd like to have a chance to listen to it a second time before I choose my... eating meals.
That's right.
And I noticed you went from the right-hand page back to the left-hand page, so that would be something that had gelled within your mind. So
recently.
Went to the right-hand
page. It's because of the question Burke asked on trinitization. When I worked on the appendix, and I realized I better say something in here too. Well, there's a relationship between them. God's escape from infinity. Can you hear all right, Bert? Let us go back in our study, back to near the beginning, back to where God is separating, qualifying deity from not deity, the unqualified. In doing this, he is escaping from a situation in which he fills total reality, infinity. We started with a picture of one circle, squeezed it into an hourglass, then separated the two lobes so that we had two circles, and one of the circles had a dot in it. This circle with the dot is our symbol for deity, and the dot is the symbol for God's will. It's been so long since I've read this, I forgot about it.
Boy, I've forgotten what the dot was.
At this point in the study, God actually fills all of this second circle. He fills total deity. He is total deity. He has escaped from filling up total reality, but he is still spread out all over total deity. Now, when God separates himself from the Son and they produce the Spirit, then, A, he personally escapes from the situation in which he fills up all of total deity himself. B, he is able to enjoy the association of two other equal beings. Three is a minimum social group. C, at the same time in the Trinity, the three deities retain that oneness which still fills and dominates total deity. In a sense, he removes the dot and replaces it by three concentric circles.
Well, as he's going out the front door,
mm-hmm.
unified deity is
coming in the back. Side door or the back
right
door,
back.
The Trinity.
Right.
As he's leaving, the Trinity is entering.
Right.
And that means he's got to trinitize in the same process. This is like the story of some magnificent break for liberty. God starts out so completely alone and so utterly infinite that he could hardly do anything. He fills everything. There is nothing but God anywhere, and no room for anything except God. So he begins to make some room. He moves away from a part of total reality, infinity. He leaves it unqualified, the unqualified absolute. That which he moves is the qualified absolute, total deity. Then he manages to withdraw as a person from total deity. This he accomplishes by separating himself from the absolute person who becomes the Son, and then by uniting with the Son in trinitizing the Spirit, and then by consummating the deity union of all three in the Paradise Trinity. The Trinity union restores the original unity of undivided deity as it was before God became the Father of the Eternal Son. Deity remains undivided in the Trinity, notwithstanding that there are now three persons of deity. I don't think we've got it quite yet, but it's better than it was before, and we can make it still better.
Using the word God there.
I'm misusing the word God all the way through for simplicity. I don't want to talk about the I am.
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk about the infinite, but I'm going to misuse the word God and then apologize and say we've really been talking about pre-God. Again, I'm going to sacrifice some technicalities for feeling and then be scholar enough to say I know I've been wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway. The paradise, when you say God, everyone knows what you mean.
Yeah.
The Paradise Trinity enables God to be personally free from the limitations of being absolute and infinite, while retaining and maintaining the absolute unity of deity. As the Trinity, the three deities are still one, and as one, they still dominate total deity. And through total deity, they still dominate and control total infinite reality. Only by virtue of the Trinity could God enjoy the personality association of the Son and the Spirit and still maintain the absolute indivisibility of deity and the actual working control of total deity and of total reality. As an example now for footnotes, which I've been skipping, for a more detailed analysis of Trinity and for references to the paper, see Appendix 10, Section 2, The Nature of Trinity, Appendix 23, Section 1, The Gestalt of a Trinity. Now this is entitled to intrigue curiosity.
Have you defined Gestalt?
I defined Gestalt in Appendix 23, Section 1. You want to read the Gestalt of a Trinity?
What is it, German? What is it, a German word?
It's non-translatable. I'll read that section right here.
Oh.
We'll just jump over Appendix 23.
How do you see that? We're out of the book.
It'll be in the back end of the book.
If you want to be the scholar.
This is Appendix 23, Section 1, The Gestalt of a Trinity. The binding force that holds together the structure of a Trinity, this is in the introduction of the appendix, The Trinity of Trinity. The binding force that holds together the structure of a Trinity, or a multiple Trinity, must be divinity, the characteristic unifying and coordinating quality of deity. Now here I got a footnote for every statement almost. We know that pattern may configure matter, mind, or spirit, or any combination of them. It can characterize personalities, identities, entities, or non-living matter. It appears as a reality because of the coexistence of personality and power. In the higher sense, pattern appears because of the coexistence of deity and energy. Two objects have relationships, but if there are three or more, they eventuate a system. You've heard this before, Clay, because you corrected an error in here, and I've fixed it now. Such a system is something more than a relationship that has become complex. Its members are connected not by a relationship of each part to other parts, but rather by a relationship of each part to the whole. Each one of the parts has a positional value in relation to the pattern of the whole. In a human being, it is personality that unifies the whole, and in the structure of a Trinity, it must be divinity. It is the arrangement of the parts, their positional values, that constitutes the pattern of the whole, with its unpredictable factors and its super-additive qualities. A Trinity is a super-summation of its constituent parts. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and the functions of the whole are more than and other than the predictable sum of the total of the collective attributes of the parts. To illustrate this, let us establish the difference between a non-pattern aggregation and the pattern of a system. The simplest system requires three parts, so let us take three objects of the same size, say three pennies, and let them fall at random on a tabletop. They fall by chance, and their positions have no particular significance, no meaningful relationship. This is a chance action, and we end up with three pennies on the top of a table and nothing more. There is a pattern of sorts, but it is an asymmetrical triangle, a scalene triangle. Now, let us do this all over again, but differently. We pick up the three pennies, but this time we place them very carefully on the table. We place them in such manner that they make a perfectly symmetrical triangle. We still have three pennies on top of the table, but now we also have a triangle. Each penny now has a positional value. But this positional value is not due to the parts. It is due to the significance which the whole imparts to its members. The triangle is the gestalt. There is no English word for it. Configuration of the whole comes close. Pattern of the whole is better, but neither is quite right. Triangularity is a quality of the whole that could not be predicted by any prior analysis of any of the parts. The appearance of such a pattern of the whole signifies mind action and purpose in imposing the pattern of a system on what would otherwise be a mere aggregation. We would suggest that the quality of triangularity is comparable to the structure of the entity of a trinity. See, when you arrange those pennies and you suddenly have a perfect triangle, where did the triangle come from? It's not any one of the pennies. It's something bigger than any one penny. It is a property of the whole, not a property of the part. And that's why a trinity is so different from the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. Or you add up the Father, Son, and Spirit, you still don't get the trinity. You add up three pennies, you've got three pennies. But you arrange them and you have a triangle. Or with four.
Where did you get that word, Gestalt?
It's a German word.
Oh.
It's a, I happen to have studied German. And I missed the word in English. It's in the Unabridged Dictionary, incidentally. Our Unabridged Dictionary.
Oh.
It's used in psychology. There's a school of psychology called Gestalt Psychology. And there is no English word for it. G-E-S-T-A-L-T. You can look it up in Webster's Unabridged.
Are you comparing personality?
They're analogous, but not homologous. They're similar, but not the same. They produce some of the same effects.
They produce a pattern.
They unify
the attributes.
Yes. Right.
Character attributes.
Example, a human being, you can analyze a human being. You can break him down into body, temperament, Douglas glands, physiological functions, thinking, worshiping, and the whole gishmir, and you still haven't explained Clyde Goodman, have you?
Mm-hmm.
Because Clyde Goodman is something more than the addition of these things. Clyde Goodman is Clyde Goodman, and there is a unity there. There's a gestalt. There's a wholeness. And each one of you feels that intuitively when you think about yourself. You're not just an aggregation of parts. You're a reasonable unity, aren't you? And that's what a trinity is. But again, we get bugged with trinity because in our experience, the thing that does this is personality. And now we're looking at something which in the Paradise Trinity is perfectly unified, but there's no personality involved. The thing that unifies the trinity, the glue that holds it together, must be divinity. It's a similar process accomplished by different means. When they get through with us in the local universe, we'll be relatively completely unified personalities. But the whole thing that there are two things that accomplish this. We have a spirit nucleus around which we can build, and the unifying agent is personality. In the Paradise Trinity, the unifying agent is divinity, I think, because the Trinity is not a person. It gives rise to persons, and it's related to persons, but it itself is not a person. Oh, dear, pardon me while I have some tea. Now, I think that if we say this simply in the story, we're going to satisfy most people. For the scholar, swell. He wants to go back and dig farther, we got it for him. We tell him where to look. And then from the appendices, we tell him where to look at the papers. We tell him where we got these ideas. The non-scholar won't care about our distortions in here, and the scholar will forgive us because we own up to them. We know we're distorting. The Paradise Trinity as the eternal thesis. When we view the Trinity in conjunction with perfect Avona, we are looking at the existential thesis of perfection. Avona is the expression of Paradise potential in actuality. The Trinity and the personal deities of Paradise are the source of the divine pattern of perfection that is the final goal of all evolutionary growth on all sub-absolute levels, finite or absonite. That is the final goal of all evolutionary growth on all sub-absolute levels, finite or absolute. Here again we encounter some terms that should be defined. Finite reality is time-space reality. It is the kind of reality that we are used to. Post-Havona finite reality is experiential, not existential. And such finites have origins in time. They may be future eternals, but never past eternals. Absonite reality is something new in the papers. It is the middle reality, in between finite and absolute. This reality is sometimes called transcendental. It transcends time and space, but does not ignore them. See Appendix 15, Section 4, the meanings of the word absonite. Absolute reality is timeless and spaceless. Absolutes are not even conscious of time and space. A good illustration of this with regard to timelessness is the adjuster that indwelt Jesus, who stated that he was completely unaware of the reality of time. Page 1516, paragraph 4. This level is eternal and existential. Some absolute realities are also experiential. The deity absolute is one of these. The Paradise Trinity functions on all three of these levels and seems to get things started on each level. The Trinity and deities of Paradise give origin to those personalities who come out into time and space and start the whole evolutionary process. The administration of the central universe and of the superuniverses is of Trinity origin. Section 4, the uniqueness of Havona. And facing this, we have a picture of the central universe. The last item on our inventory of existential and eternal realities is Havona, the central and divine universe. Havona is by far the most interesting part of the master universe. It is so unique, it is so difficult to classify. At the very beginning of this prologue, we considered the paradoxical fact that eternal Havona never was actually created. And yet, to all practical intents and purposes, we think of the central creation. And it functions as a true creation at the present time in the Second Age. But in the First Age, Havona was entirely alone. It was an isolated universe. It was completely isolated because there was nothing but empty space outside of it. In these remote times, it had no external relationships, only relationships within itself and inwardly toward Paradise. Havona is also difficult to classify in terms of the levels of functional reality. It is neither finite nor absonite, nor is it absolute. Beings exist and things are happening in Havona on each of these three functional levels. Because of this, it is almost impossible to put the central universe in a specific category. It is a creation that never was created. The creatures that live in Havona never were created. It is finite in space, just so large and no larger, but it is much more than finite when we consider what is going on in the affairs of its billion perfect world. Havona is really something of everything. It is the pattern universe which God created, and it probably has the capacity to serve as a pattern creation for any local universe, for the seven super universes, for the whole master universe, or for anything else that might develop on beyond the master universe. Section 5, the architects of the master universe. Before we leave the study of the First Age, we should consider a rather unusual group of beings, the architects of the master universe. These beings are not created, they are eventuated. This is a new word, and it should be defined. eventuated has a special meaning in the papers. It is a word that describes how someone is brought into being, like the word created, but eventuated does not mean created. It certainly means some sort of initiating act that is pre-time, pre-creative, or of eternity status. We are informed that God as a person creates, as a super-person, he eventuates. Absonite beings, the transcendentalers, are not created. They are eventuated. These eventuated master architects are present in the first age. There is even a possibility that they were present before the first age. But we may be quite sure that they are present and functional in the first age. The master architects are not finite, neither are they absolute. They are absonite beings, which is to say, they are transcendentalers. The architects are not creators, neither are they creatures. They seem to be almost like living and intelligent blueprints or architects' plans of the master universe. They personify God's plan for the entire master creation. They begin their work in the post-Tavona creations long before anyone else is on the scene of action. They get the space stage ready for new developments, and all of this work is in process long before the creators and the administrators of these post-Tavona universes make their appearance. They are organized for service in seven cores in accordance with the geographic plan of the central isle in the master universe, paradise, and the six concentric space levels. That's the epilogue. And we start out with study proper, the study of the master universe. This is the story of the creative and the evolutional expansion of paradise, Tavona divinity, into time and space. It is also the story of the consolidation of such expansion on finite levels in the supreme and on absonite levels in the ultimate. It begins but cannot finish the story that goes on beyond the ultimate. This study is presented in three main parts: the finite story, the absonite story, the beginning of the last story. This study properly begins when the past eternal age of Tavona gives way to an age that has an origin in time, the second age, the one in which we are now living. This study will have to come to an end not long after the last age of the master universe has closed in time and has given way to an age that is future eternal. Shall I go on? Yes.
Have you embellished or enhanced one layman like me picture of paradise in relation to
the central universe?
Lay people will be quite interested in paradise.
I don't get into paradise too much, except in one appendix, because it's not really a part of the master universe.
But can it be tied in? Can it be hung out there on a tether? Can it be?
We maybe ought to talk more about paradise.
It ought to be talked more about, Bill.
Well,
I mean, you got a point.
You got a point. Make a note. Berkeley. We may. Well, I don't know. It's getting awful big. But we can say something.
Well, you could say that the master universe existed.
We deal with paradise as one of the seven absolutes of infinity. We could say more about paradise. Maybe should, because as I think about it now, we're a little bit skimpy.
Give a clear juxtaposition.
I got pictures in here. No. For example.
I have more pictures too, someplace.
Yeah.
They're short, Bill, but I mean,
these are the things I want to get, and we'll file them in here, and then we get back to working on what we got.
I'll let him mix it up.
Yeah.
He sees 50 new terms, and he don't see paradigm mentioned but one.
That's right.
Paradox, all he's heard all his life.
That's right.
Give him a little meat.
Good enough. Well, here's the introduction to the study. Actually, what is the Master Universe? Do we have very much of an understanding of what the papers mean when they speak of it? Do we have any proper understanding of how God's purposes are unfolding in the Master Universe? Do we have an appreciation of the purpose of the Master Universe itself? Section 1, the uses of the word universe. The papers make use of the word universe in several different ways. They speak of local universes, super universes, of the central universe and the grand universe, and the Master Universe. Havona is the name of the central universe. This is the creation that immediately surrounds paradise. The Isle of Paradise is not a part of any universe. It is the motionless and absolute center of all material things. Havona is encircled by the seven superuniverses. And Arvantan is the name of the seventh superuniverse, our superuniverse. Each superuniverse is designed to embrace exactly 100,000 local universes. And Nevadon is the name of our local universe. When the papers want to speak about the central universe plus the seven superuniverses, they use the name Grand Universe. This is the presently organized and inhabited creation. It stands in contrast to the unorganized and uninhabited space regions outside of it, the four outer space levels. When the papers desire to speak of the Grand Universe plus these four outer space levels, they use the term Master Universe. In this study, when we want to refer to these four outer space levels alone, we will use the term Outer Universes or Outer Space Universes. The term Universe of Universes is also used in the Urantia papers. This term is not precisely defined. It can be roughly defined as the grand universe with or without the outer space levels. This term will not be used in this study except where it is unavoidable. Section 2, Universe Space Levels. The best general description of the Master Universe appears in the papers on page 128 in Section 1, Space Levels of the Master Universe. The story which is given there presents a picture of the master creation as consisting of six concentric and elliptical space levels. Each of these space levels has two names that are used rather interchangeably as tabulated below. One, the Havona space level, or the central universe. Two, the superuniverse space level, or the seven superuniverses. Three, the first outer space level, the primary space level. Four, the second outer space level, the secondary space level. Five, the third outer space level, the tertiary space level. Six, the fourth outer space level, the quartan space level. I get a map facing this page. In this study, we will find the concept of these six space levels to be most helpful to the organization of our thinking. Section 3, Universe Ages. There's another concept presented in the papers that we will find most useful. This is the concept of the six successive universe ages. The papers present each universe age as a period of time that is associated with the opening up and the development of a new space level. This relationship is presented in the following tabulation. The first universe age, Havona. Second, super universes. Third, primary space level. Fourth, secondary space level. Fifth, tertiary space level. The sixth universe age, the quartan space level. We will study the growth and development of the Master Universe, paying particular attention to the sequence of events. how the universe ages synchronize the expansion of the paradise creative forces and personalities outward into the concentric space levels. Section 4, the scheme of this inquiry. It is the intent of this study to see what we can learn about God's purpose through a careful study of the Master Universe. We will try to bring together whatever the papers have to say about the Master Creation and its space levels and its universe ages. If we can assemble the pertinent data, then by interpolation and extrapolation, we may be able to add a little to our understanding of the Master Creation and to our understanding of God's plans for the creators and the creatures of this widespreading domain. There are many questions which can be raised and to which we may seek answers. This study proposes to examine such questions as these. 1. How large is the space level? How do they compare in size? How big are the outer space levels in comparison to the grand universe? How large is the grand universe? How large is the whole master universe? 2. How long a time is the universe age? Do some ages last longer than others? Do the ages have any relationships other than sequence? Is there any qualitative difference between universe ages? Or are any such differences merely a matter of duration, quantity of time? 4. How is the growth of experiential deity related to the universe ages? What relationships exist between these deity evolutions and the expanding space levels? How is the development of the two experiential trinities related to the universe ages and to the universe space levels? 4. What creative themes and principles have developed, are developing, and may yet develop in the successive ages and on the expanding space stages of the six concentric space levels? Can we discover any basic principles which seem to underlie these events? 5. How is man, as a finaliter, related to all these developments in the present age and in the future ages, on the present space stage of the grand universe, and on the future space stages of the outer universe? 6. Is the master universe the final creation? Or will it, in the distant future, exist in relation to something even greater than itself? 7. What are the final limits? What is the final goal? We propose to investigate these questions by an examination of the successive universe ages. There was just one age before the present one. This was the first universe age, the Age of Havona. We've already given consideration to this age in the prologue to our study. We are now living in the second age, the age of the superuniverses, and we will begin our study with an examination of this present universe age. After this, we will undertake the study of the four future ages of the Master Universe, the successive ages of the four outer space levels. When we encounter gaps in the available data, we will make an effort to bridge them by intensive and extensive reasoning. We well understand that all such types of speculative reasoning are bound to suffer from the limitations inherent in our human ignorance. Nevertheless, at the very least, we may achieve a better unification of ignorance as a result of these efforts. So, let us embark adventuresomely on our study of the Master Universe, its lengthening ages, its widening space levels, and its ever-expanding scope of creator and creature self-realization. Let us embark with all due humility, but nonetheless with courage. The Finite Story. This is the story of the evolution of the seven superuniverses. Most of the papers are concerned with this narrative. This is the tale of creation and of evolution in time and space, and of how all these activities find their destiny in the perfected superuniverses under the sovereignty of the Supreme Being. This story is presented in three chapters. Chapter 1, The Creative Thesis of Perfection, The Dawn of Time, Beginning of the Second Age, God the Sevenfold, creative deity, second age Havona, the thesis of perfection. Chapter 2, The Evolutionary Antithesis, the challenge of imperfection, growth capacity, God the Sevenfold, evolutional deity, the challenge of power personality synthesis, challenge and response. Chapter 3, First Synthesis, God the Supreme, the completed grand universe, creative associations of dual deity, sun and spirit in the second age. This is the story of the second universe age. It begins with the creation of the master spirits and the ancients of days. It ends with the completed evolution of the Supreme Being. This is the story of here and now. In each case, I've got a little fly sheet which introduces what comes ahead. Chapter 1, The Creative Thesis of Perfection. With the opening of the second universe age, the present age, we have actually started our study of the master universe. This second age, like the four ages that follow it, is comprehensible. It had an origin in time, and it will have an ending in time. It is of definite duration. After our excursion into past eternity in the prologue, this is comforting. Section 1, The Dawn of Time, Beginning of the Second Age. Just what is it that ends the Age of Havona and begins the Age of the Superuniverses? As we study the papers, it is apparent that this was not a sudden happening. It came about gradually, like the dawning of a new day. The twilight of the first age gradually became the dawn of the second age. Long before the second age was an official reality, we suspect that the architects of the master universe had their deputies, the force organizers, out in the super universe space level, working on the mobilization of energy, organizing nebulae, and getting things physically started in anticipation of events to come. Probably the first event that would really be post-eternal, post-Havona, was the creation of the seven master spirits. These high personalizations of paradise deity are not absolute beings, but they represent paradise deity on every level below the absolute, finite, absonite, and finite absonite, or to state it in more usual language, supreme, ultimate, and supreme ultimate. And these master spirits are not existential. They are experiential. They are the first expressions of experiential deity. They also personally express the seven possible combinations of the three persons of deity: Father, Son, Spirit, Father, Son, Father, Spirit, Son, Spirit, and Father, Son, Spirit. There could not possibly be any more or any fewer master spirits. Seven are all that is mathematically possible. And this is why the superuniverse space level was divided into seven parts. Each master spirit presides over and pervades one of the seven superuniverses. Sometime during this twilight period, another thing happened. God the Supreme appeared in Havona. His presence was derived from the Paradise Trinity, and he came into existence as a spirit person. He was resident in the central universe before the superuniverses were formally organized. But then as now, he was not contactable by creatures. Then came the mandate of the Paradise Trinity organizing the grand universe, the seven superuniverses in relation to Havona. And at about this time, the Trinity must have created the 21 Ancients of Days, the triune rulers of the seven supercreations. Shortly thereafter, the headquarters worlds of the seven superuniverses were constructed, and the Ancients of Days probably departed from Paradise to take up residence on their respective capital spheres. As the papers say, they have ruled the superuniverses since near eternity. Now that's got a jillion references behind it, but I covered with just one here. See Appendix 4, Section 5A, the transitional times between the first and second ages. There's 2.5 pages of solid notes in support of that page and a half of text. At some later point in time, the Father and Son must have begun the creation of the Creator Sons, with the Infinite Spirit responding by the complemental production of creative spirits. In due time, the oldest of the local universes were commissioned, and now the second age is in full bloom. Soon the evolutionary mortals made their appearance on the worlds of space, and then began the long paradise ascent of the pilgrims of time in the quest for the Universal Father. See Appendix 7, The Chronology of Local Universes. I hope these references will intrigue people.
Enough to look them up.
Yeah. In Appendix 7, for example, I pulled together all that the papers have to say about how does a local universe come into being, specifically ours. And I've got it set up chronologically from the first action on space potency and how it is conjectured it's done to the primary force organizers, secondaries, and right on down to the era of the bestowals and then unto the unknown future. Experiential beings. All these newly appearing beings are experiential in nature. They are not existential. And this is true from the creature level of mortal man right on up to the deity levels of the Master Spirits and God the Supreme. These beings do not know all before they have experienced all. They have the capacity to learn and to grow with learning and living. This is true even of the creators themselves, and is most clearly seen in the creators of the local universes, the Creator Sons and the Creative Spirits. Service in the time-space creations, experience in the organizing and perfecting of the local universes, changes the status of these universe sons and spirits. They grow. Section 2. God the Sevenfold, Creative Deity. The association of God the Sevenfold began to function when the superuniverses were organized. God the Sevenfold is a creative, associative expansion of the Paradise deities into time and space. This is their method of making contact with all the creatures of the super and local universes. God the Sevenfold provides the living ladder of divine personalities that bridge the gap between man and the Paradise Father. This deity association functions on 7 levels, and its members are classified in 3 major groups: the Paradise deities, the Father, Son, and Spirit; experiential deity, the Supreme Being; the core of Supreme Creators, Master Spirits, Ancients of Days, Creator Sons. We are familiar with the Paradise deities, Father, Son, and Spirit. The core of the Supreme Creators is something new. These are the Creators who make their appearance after Eternal Havona. They are the post-Havona Creators. Theirs is the work of organizing and perfecting the 7 superuniverses and the projected 700,000 local universes. Each of the Master Spirits pervades one of the superuniverses, thus determining its individual nature. By threes, the Ancients of Days function as the direct rulers of the 7 supercreations. The Creator Sons and their associated creative spirits organize the local universes and create or evolve the living beings who are native to these realms. The Supreme Being is an evolving experiential deity. He is slowly emerging and actualizing as a result of the successes of the Supreme Creators in the time-space realms, as a result of their successful collaboration with Paradise Deity, and as a result of his own efforts to grow. Creative Deity. At this point, we should stop to consider that deity appears to be working on a new level of activity. Back in the prologue, we recognize that deity started out on the static level, progressed to the potential level, and was working on the associative level at the dawn of the first age. Apparently, one of the basic differences between the first and the second ages is deity's entrance upon the fourth level of activity, the creative level. What does this mean? It means that deity is now beginning to draw upon the great reservoirs of potential, the three absolutes. These basic potentials, pre-spirit, pre-mind, and pre-matter, are now being so transformed that they are beginning to emerge in the new universes as new spirit, new mind, and new matter. The creative process is actually a transforming process. Potentials are transformed into actuals, and something new has come into existence. It may be a new spirit personality, a new level of the function of mind, or the organization of a new physical nebula in space that will become the material substance of some new local universe. All of these new realities have to come from somewhere, and the somewhere from which they emerge is, in the final analysis, the three absolutes of potentiality. Section 3. Havona in the Second Age, the thesis of perfection. In the prologue to our study, we gave consideration to Havona in the First Age. There we studied Havona as a pre-creative existence, something that actually had no beginning. Technically, this is probably the correct way to classify the central universe. But from a practical standpoint, when we consider Havona in relation to the superuniverses, it is a creation. It is the pattern universe of divine perfection. Havona in the Second Age is the divine thesis of perfection, God's challenge to the imperfection of the encircling evolutionary universes. To each creature, God has made a challenging invitation. Be you perfect, even as I am perfect. To all the creator sons and creative spirits in the evolutionary local universes, Havona presents God's challenge of a universe of divine perfection. And this is the challenge. Can these universe sons and spirits, by creative and experiential processes, duplicate in time the eternal perfection of existential Havona? Coming events cast their shadows. If Havona is a challenge to the superuniverses in all of their need are no less of a challenge to Havona. And the central creation began to respond to this challenge long before the first of the mortal ascenders ever reached these settled realms. As the first age entered into its twilight period, that is also the dawn of the second age, change for the first time entered changeless Havona. New beings appeared. The seven circuits of Havona are eternal, but now circuit spirits were discovered to be in function in each of these seven divisions. Power centers took up their perpetual stations in the seven circuits. Universal sensors were assigned to each of the billion spheres. The central creation is preparing itself for the events of the future. Grand Fanda. When Grand Fanda, the first mortal pilgrim, arrived in Havona, this event triggered a multitude of new developments. New orders of the ministering spirits, secondary supernathim, appeared. The citizens of paradise began their pilgrimage outward through Havona. The first of the graduate guides greeted Grand Fanda, and many other changes must have taken place in the universe of divine perfection. The ascenders from the super universes are bringing the seeds of the evolutionary growth process into the central creation. In the second age, Havona is still pre-creative and eternal, but it has also become creative and changing, even evolutional. More? Chapter 2. evolutionary antithesis. In the present age, the central and divine universe is obviously the creative thesis of perfection. The superuniverses, starting out as they do as imperfect creations, are the great antithesis to Havona perfection. These imperfect universes constitute the greatest possible challenge to the personalities of Paradise and Havona, the creators and administrators of the evolutionary domains of realms of time and space. Theirs was the first great adventure, the supreme adventure, the bringing of the perfection of eternity and divinity out into the evolutionary domains of original imperfection. God the Sevenfold was and is the deity response to the challenge of imperfection. And God the Sevenfold brings the counter-challenge of divine perfection into the very heart of the evolutionary realms, even to the inhabited worlds themselves, in the creature bestowals of the Paradise Sons of God. Section 1, The Challenge of Imperfection. This study advances the opinion that God Himself is possessed of those qualities of being that are ancestral to that enjoyment of adventure, a response to the stimulus of adventure that appears in the character of progressive creatures. Why else would he suddenly confront the Paradise Havona system of eternal perfection with a startling challenge of the abysmal imperfection of the seven superuniverses? In the first universe age, everything is in balance. All is orderly. The spheres of eternal Havona swing in settled and established orbits around the motionless Isle of Paradise. Disharmony is unknown. Disorder has never appeared. Total creation follows an unchanging pattern of flawless perfection, age upon age, and age after age. And then, God expands this perfectly balanced and symmetrical creation. He expands the organized universe outward and spaceward. Suddenly it encompasses new and outlying realms, realms of unsettled physical development, realms of imperfect nature, realms in which creatures of imperfection will soon appear, realms of potential evil, realms in which potential evil will all too often become actual evil, even sin, through the unwise choice of imperfect creatures. Think, pause to think, how startling and unprecedented were these challenges of long ago to the inerrant beings of eternity. What was their first reaction to dissonance, these beings who had known nothing but harmony? How did they first regard disorder, these beings who had known nothing but the pattern of flawless perfection? What was their response to potential evil, these beings who had always chosen the good in the absence of all contrastive evil? And what was their reaction when, for the first time in their experience, potential evil became actual evil through creature choice? And what a shock it must have been when evil plus insincerity equivalated to sin, even to iniquity. Suddenly, so to speak, we have a vast creation teeming with imperfect creatures, and every one of them has been endowed with the priceless power of choice by God Himself. Each one of these creatures is a sovereign within himself. Each one of them can choose, pro or con, concerning citizenship in the universe and sonship with God, and no one dare interfere with these choices, lest he find himself trespassing the will of God, for it is God who gives to creatures this priceless power of choice. Without this power of choice, without God's gift of personality, we would be very little more than living machines. But with this gift of relative free will, we are more than machines. We are men, and we may choose to be even more than men. We may choose to be ascending sons of God, and we may also choose badly and keep on choosing badly, and no one can stop us, only time and oblivion. This was the challenge of long ago, which confronted the citizens of the eternal realms. They embarked upon this adventure, the supreme adventure, when they left the settled domains of divine perfection and came out into the new creative frontier, into the new space level of the super universes, there to take up posts as the creators, organizers, and administrators of the unsettled and uncertain evolutionary domains of time. And who but God would have dared to unite the purest form of spirit with the lowest type of creature capable of being endowed with personality, mortal man? Here truly is the bringing together of the highest and the lowest. And who but God would so combine the spirit of adventure with that divine love which would cause an infinite being to be willing to enter into everlasting partnership with the mortal children of the animal origin races of the inhabited world? If these actions and transactions are not exciting and adventurous and unpredictable, then what is or could be? Suddenly, so to speak, the existential perfection of the flawless creations of eternity is challenged by the appearance of the antithesis of perfection, by the appearance of the imperfect and evolutionary domains of time and space. Clyde, as I've tried to go back and relive this and think it through, this was just excitement of the first magnitude. Now, I'll bet you there's more than one creature from the central universe that thought the boss had flipped his wig on this one.
Yeah.
We may think the same thing
for
that.
That's right. God the sevenfold, evolutional deity. That's another word picture I've tried to draw. And these are things you can't read. You've got to see them like pictures. But wherever we get a real tough conception that could lend itself to a layout on a page, I think we should take it out of the text and treat it like a picture. God the sevenfold, evolutional deity. See, now we had a section in the previous chapter we called God the sevenfold, creative deity. I think we got to look at the sevenfold from two standpoints. God the sevenfold is the deity response to the challenge of imperfection. As we have noted in our study of creative deity, this sevenfold association began to function at the time of the organization of the super universes. There are several ways of presenting this association. You want to pass it down?
Mm-hmm.
There are several ways of studying this association of deity, and one of them is to consider the sevenfold from a functional standpoint. The summary facing this page makes such a presentation of God the Sevenfold. Emphasis is placed on the three interacting groups that function within this association. A, the Supreme Creators. B, the Supreme Being. C, Triune Paradise Deity. On that page, I've tried to set up the seven members of God the Sevenfold grouped in these three levels, with enough of a paragraph there so that you read that page, you've got a feeling of what the sevenfold is up to. The various beings who are collaborating in these three groups of the sevenfold are working on the associative, creative, and evolutional levels of deity activity in time and space.